Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a veteran journalist reporting on issues of UK and global security, covering terrorist attacks, hostage taking, and explaining the complexities of Middle Eastern politics. A fluent Arabist with a degree in Arabic and Islamic studies, in 2004, whilst in Saudi Arabia, he was ambushed and shot several times by Islamist gunmen, leaving him in a wheelchair. He's written an acclaimed memoir, the best-selling Blood and Sand, and a much-praised account of his life as an inveterate traveller and explorer, Far Horizons. He's also written for The Economist, The Sunday Times, The Daily Telegraph and Time Out, and he's been published in the best of Sunday Times travel writing. He's now produced a wonderful thriller. In 2005, he was awarded an OBE for services to journalism. He is Frank Gardner. Frank, I want you to take me back to a bus journey in your childhood, which I understand changed your life.
Yes, gosh, it's always worrying when interviewers have done far more research than I'd expected. You're absolutely right. I was 16. I was on a bus with my mum, and we bumped into this tall, very distinguished sort of Victorian traveller-looking person, and she said, "Do you realise who that is? That's Wilfred Thesiger." And of course, I'd never heard of him. She said, "Trust me, he's really interesting." She knew him, and he invited us to tea. We went to his place in Chelsea, and he'd just come back from another Middle East trip. And this was the man who'd crossed the empty quarter of Arabia in the 40s and 50s, done these epic journeys, which he wrote up in Arabian Sands, crossing these 600-foot-high dunes with nothing but camels and a few sort of scrawny bits of dead rabbit to eat. And he totally inspired me. He didn't mean to. In fact, he tried to put me off. He said, no, Middle East is totally ruined by oil. So he was a little bit eccentric that, you know, he had known the Middle East before oil, or when it was before most people had discovered the benefits of that oil had brought. And he had done these amazing journeys crossing whole vast uninhabited parts of Arabia in the Middle East and written them up in these inspiring books. And I thought, this is what I want to do.
Before that, of course, you'd had quite an exotic childhood, travelling around all over the place.
I grew up in Holland, which to me, as a six-year-old, seemed incredibly exotic. You know, everything was J's and K's, and it was Dutch accent is this wonderfully sort of, and it's the Dutch G is the same as the Arabic KH, the Khaf. So I had to learn a bit of Dutch at school. And the one really important phrase I learned was, Ik weet alleen een beetje Hollands, omdat ik ben Engels. And that was enough to bring a big smile to people's face. And of course, the Dutch speak perfect English, and there's no real need to learn Dutch. But it was a very good grounding linguistically, because it meant that it wasn't too much of a battle to learn Arabic after that.
Well, of course, we know now why you were inspired to learn Arabic. Where did you learn and where did you take it?
I started teaching myself the Arabic alphabet when I should have been doing my history A-level revision. So I'd be sitting in a library in some rainy Wiltshire afternoon, and I should have been learning about King George III's cabinet, when actually I was learning how the different Arabic script, sort of how it all connects and where the dots go and the dashes and things. So I then applied to Exeter University to read Arabic, and it was the only university at the time that sent you away for a whole year. The other universities said, it's up to you to find something to do in the summer. Exeter sent you for a whole year. It was ahead of its time. Now that's normal. They send people to Jordan now, and with the Arab Spring, it keeps changing. It used to be Egypt or Damascus. Both of those are a bit iffy now, so it's Jordan. And that was the most formative year, I think, for me. I was 21, and I loved that year. I totally immersed myself in Egypt and its language and its culture and its sights and smells and food, and I lived with an Egyptian family for a lot of the time. So it was a really wonderful time with huge sense of humour they've got, the Egyptians. I mean, Cairo is a city built for 1 million people that's now, 15 million people? It's held together by string in some ways. And they have these wonderful expressions there. A road sweeper will address another road sweeper as Ya Rais, O President. You know, they've got this great sense of irony.
When you talk about Arabic as a language, it's more than one language, really, isn't it? I mean, there are a lot of different dialects.
There are different dialects and different pronunciations, definitely. I mean, you know, an Omani will not really understand a Moroccan if he's speaking in Moroccan, because there's a lot of Berber mixed in there, and they tend to have this, you know, it's always a kind of glottal stop way of pronouncing things. I learned Egyptian Arabic in the back streets there. Because of the films, Egypt being is the sort of Bollywood of the Arab world, and everybody knows Egyptian Arabic, but it's a very comical sing-song Arabic. It's very sing-song and musical. And when I arrived in the Gulf speaking Egyptian Arabic, people said, why are you talking like a taxi driver? What's up with you? Because the Gulfy Arabic is much more sort of slow and languorous. And Syrian Arabic is even more sort of shul hakim, sharif shlon, sharif kif. It's almost sort of teasing. So every country has a different dialect. And probably the most straightforward is Saudi or Yemeni or Sudanese.
Where did you take that knowledge of Arabic?
Initially, nowhere. I graduated with the great myth. We were told that with a degree in Arabic in the 1980s, the world was our oyster. We were totally unemployable unless you combined it with an actual industry skill like banking or medicine or accountancy or law or journalism, you know, a core industry skill. Then it was a real USP, a unique selling point. So I didn't really know what to do with it. I walked around London looking for a job, knocked on doors of anything that began with Middle East, took the first job I was offered, £6,000 a year, Middle East Gulf exports, which sounds like a cover for something dodgy, but it really wasn't. They exported cosmetics and chocolates to the Middle East. And it was a tiny firm, and yeah, the chocolates kept melting, the perfume caps kept coming off. I did it for a year. It was great fun. But then I was very lucky to get into the city. I had no financial experience at all, but I was taken on probation, sent to New York, did 6 months in Wall Street, and had a great time. I was living the life of a student and being paid as a banker. You know, what's not to like? So that was a lot of fun. And I stuck banking for about 9 years altogether, far longer than I'd intended, because I was a square peg in a round hole. But it allowed me to get into the Middle East and spend time in places like Jeddah and Abu Dhabi and Kuwait. And then what I would do is I would have 2 or 3 days of meetings and then take 2 days off and go climbing in the mountains in southwest Saudi. So that was, and what I really enjoyed was doing these kind of late night meetings with sheikhs and merchants and traders and kicking off the shoes and just chatting to them and getting to know them and enjoying the art of conversation, because they would never do business on meeting number one or two or three. It would be eventually, so tell me, Frank, you know, you've been here a few times. What does your company do? Tell me what they offer. You know, let's talk business. And they'd sort of, you'd circle around each other and decide if you liked each other. And I love that way of doing business. And while I was there, we raised $2 billion in funds under management. So it was a successful time.
And it illustrates just that it's really not just about language. You've really got to have a complete understanding of a totally different culture.
Definitely, yeah, because during Ramadan is a time when most Western business and banking people would not go to Saudi Arabia, because the whole way of life changes. Nobody really gets up before about 10 o'clock. Everyone's yawning during the day. No proper business is done during the day. But I would switch over to their timescale. I would do the same thing. I'd fast during the day. And then I get invited to the iftars, which is the breaking of the fast at sundown. So my Saudi friends would go for prayers. And then I would join them for a huge feast with the family, which is a big honor. You know, dash out with the right hand, grab as much, stuff yourself. You know, they would know if I had broken the fast during the day. I was as hungry as they were. And then they'd go off for prayers. And then I would go back to the hotel, get changed into a suit, and go and have meetings with people till 1 a.m. And it was just, it's a wonderful time, Ramadan. It's at night. It's tough during the day, particularly in summer. But you're all sharing the experience together. So even though I'm not a Muslim, I shared it with them. And it was a really lovely time. And a great honor to be with them. And I repeated it, or actually, no, it was before that. I'd spent time with the Beni Huaytat Bedouin in Jordan, where I'd lived with them in their black goat's hair tents during Ramadan, and fasting by day, feasting by night. And it's a glimpse into another world. Someone would bring out a rababa, which is the kind of stringed lute instrument, and recite qasida, early poetry, poems dating from the 7th century. And there'd be this bark from up in the hills, and one of the tribesmen would say, that's that bloody wolf who got 2 of my sheep today. You know, it's biblical.
What happened after your spell in banking?
Well, it ended rather sort of unglamorously. I'd gone as far as I should have gone. I actually probably went further than I should have gone. I was overpromoted to director and was rubbish at it in London. I was just not motivated. And so they said, do you want to go back to Bahrain? I said, no, I've done that. They said, well, you know, it's kind of, that's it, really. So I left on very good terms. And I thought, right, it's time to retrain and do what I really want to do, which is this broadcast journalism thing. I have no idea how to get into it. So I put myself through a number of courses. I knocked on a lot of doors. I joined the BFI, the British Film Institute. I joined various organizations, you know, cultural, media, film things, and would go and talk to the speaker afterwards and say, do you know anybody in news? Can you give me any contacts? And Rory Bremner was really helpful. You know, you never forget the people who help you. You also never forget the people who slam the door in your face. So he was great. And he gave me some names and suggestions. And I would go knock on doors. And eventually I got a two-week unpaid work attachment at BBC World. And as luck would have it, there was a discussion of Kuwait. How do we mark the anniversary of the invasion of Kuwait? So I was the only person in the room that had been to Kuwait. So I put my hand up and people looked at me very suspiciously. Who is this guy? You know, he's a bit older than, you know, he's already in his 30s. What is this, some spy sent from management? But I did 2 years in the newsroom there, learnt the trade and bought a camera down Tottenham Court Road, learnt how to do filming, taught myself, also watched how the cameraman worked, and then sent myself off on trips to Iran, Oman, UAE, and did films for the business unit. Because they weren't quite so demanding about production standards. But it was a great way to get into it. And I loved filming. And then I decided there was a gap in the market, Dubai. They've got nobody there. I'm going to send myself there. And BBC said, you're going to starve. There's no news there. And I said, well, there's no news because you've got nobody down there. So as soon as I landed, my phone went and it was the Today program saying, could you do a live interview about the British nurses that are in prison in Saudi? And I said, yeah, sure. And I thought, wow, suddenly I am now a foreign correspondent. I've made it. It was an amazing feeling. No training at all.
And all of that was self-funded. You went out there as a freelancer, a complete leap of faith.
It was a total leap of faith, not just for me, but for my wife as well. She was 6 months pregnant with our first child. We had absolutely no guarantee of income whatsoever. We had to put down 6 months' rent in advance, not knowing if the government was going to kick us out because they don't like... You know, they don't like investigative journalism or hard journalism at all. You know, it's all the local press is totally tame there. So it was a risk, and I knew I would have to calibrate it, that if I was going to do any critical pieces, I had to be really careful. I had to perhaps aim them at other countries before I started to metaphorically dump on my own doorstep. So, yeah, it was stressful, and getting the permission to operate there was so stressful. I actually got shingles on my thigh because it was... so stressful. I had to queue in a 40 degrees heat to go and have the blood test in order to get the residency, and you would queue up there with lots of other people, and they would use a different needle each time, but they would do it in batches of 10, and they would go off, and 3 weeks later you'd be called back, and if any of you had TB or HIV or anything like that, you'd all get called back. Fortunately, it was all clear in my batch, but it's, you know, it was a nerve-wracking time.
What happened after that?
Two great years in Dubai, really enjoyed it. Went for the job as Cairo correspondent. To my surprise, I got it. So I then became a sort of staff BBC bureau chief. And there wasn't much news going on in Cairo, so I did a lot of travelling, which was quite a strain on the family. Young family, often ill. And we did that for 2 years. Came back to... then 9/11 happened. So I did a lot of work on that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I got on Tony Blair's plane to the Middle East with a Westminster press hack, then jumped plane without telling anybody in Riyadh. They flew on to Damascus. I stayed in Riyadh and disappeared off the grid for 2 weeks and went into a place called Qasim province, Breda, which is the absolute ideological heartland of Al-Qaeda, because I wanted to understand where this phenomenon had come from. Yeah, so 9/11, I did a lot of post 9/11 sort of sweeping up stories, trying to understand this phenomenon and explain it to our audience. And it was interesting because the American networks had just laid off a lot of their foreign experts and then had to rehire them all. BBC, fortunately, thanks to World Service and others, already had a core of it. So I think we were quite well placed there. So I did a lot of traveling then, and you know, I'd do backstreet interviews, you know, as to why people thought 9/11 had happened. And you got a range of views. Some people say we feel terribly sorry for the Americans, but... they deserved it because of their policy in the Middle East. Some people would be in total denial. There's no way Arabs could have done this, you know, etc. You got a whole range of views. There was a lot of denial. It's the Jews who did it. No Jews went to work on 9/11, etc. I mean, a lot of, you know, conspiracy theories, which you still find to this day. You know, sadly, some people think that Israel did 9/11, which is totally ridiculous. I then came back to London to do 4 months in Newsnight. My undercover work in filming in Saudi was nominated for an RTS, a Royal Television Society Award. I didn't get it, unfortunately, because Simpson pipped me to the post because he'd done The Fall of Kabul, which was kind of a bigger story, really. So you can't blame them. And I then did 4 months with Newsnight and then didn't have a job. And by then I'd done, 7 years with BBC, and I had no job, which was quite scary. And the time was getting close when I was going to have to probably jump ship and go somewhere else. And then the security correspondent job came up. It wasn't called that, but it was offered. And I said, okay, you know, what are you offering? 3 months. I said, look, I'll do it for 6 months. Okay. So that was my interview. And it just ballooned from there. There were so many stories to do. And it was clear that this was a big gap in the market. And it got so busy within 2 years that they quickly spotted that we needed a second one, which is why they hired Gordon Carrera. So I've never really kind of looked back on that. And of course, I 2 years later, I then got shot in Saudi. And my cameraman, Simon Cumbers, was killed. I spent 7 months in hospital, but was back to work soon after that, still doing the same job.
If we could just revisit that time, I obviously it's not a pleasant memory in any way, but it made headlines, of course, all over the world. Why do you think that you were targeted?
We weren't targeted for who we were. It was simply an opportunistic killing by a fanatic jihadist group. It was Al-Qaeda Central, who couldn't believe their luck that two white Western journalists had come into their part of, not their part, but a part of Riyadh, a pretty dodgy part that the government should never have taken us to. It was cock-up, not conspiracy. The government minders didn't know what they were doing. They were from the Ministry of Information. And they said, oh, don't worry, everywhere in Riyadh is safe. No, it wasn't. And that was a dangerous part. They should not have taken us to it. But they underestimated how dangerous Riyadh was at that time in 2004. And you know, this was a wonderful opportunity for Al-Qaeda to embarrass their own government and kill a couple of infidels as they saw it. So they took their shots at us, killed my cameraman, left me for dead.
What has been the Saudi government reaction?
I think mainly one of embarrassment, to be honest. They, at first, I think, were hoping that the phone records on my mobile phone would prove that I had in some way been in touch with the opposition or Islamists, or in some way that we had dropped ourselves in this. But the British Metropolitan Police, together with the British Embassy, did a very, very thorough investigation with the Saudis. And they did something called an I-2 chart, which is they do a breakdown analysis of all the incoming and outgoing calls on my mobile phone, which was recovered from the scene, pretty bloodstained. And there were no dodgy numbers on it. You know, the police were quite curious about one number. It was my parents' home number in Hampshire. So they didn't get much joy there. So there was nothing on that. And I think the Saudis were very embarrassed, stopping short of apologetic. They promised compensation and never paid one penny, which is, I know why it was. It was the previous foreign minister, Prince Saud Al Faisal, blocked it. He's dead now, but I think that was just a really mean thing to do because, sure, I'd have given some of it to charity, but some of it would have eased the hardship of living suddenly as a disabled person, you know, getting on planes. I can't go on long, really long plane journeys economy because I will get a pressure sore on my bum. So, you know, I have to pay for that, for the difference between economy and business. They could have helped there. You know, it's not like Saudi Arabia was short of money. They're rolling in it. So I'm still miffed at that because they insisted we took these minders who didn't know what they were doing. They got us into a situation that we got shot, and they should have done the decent thing and paid both Simon Cumbers' family and mine compensation. What we did with it after that is up to us. Anyhow, look, I'm only talking about it now because you bring it up, but I honestly don't go through any day thinking about this. I only ever talk about it or think about it if somebody brings it up.
Your literary career, when did that begin?
Gosh, doesn't that sound great, my literary career? I'm liking
but it is
phrase.
It is a career because it's now, how many books?
This is my third book now, Crisis. Yeah, I mean, the first one was a sort of, I suppose, a fairly obvious thing to do. I was, as soon as the bullet wound in my shoulder, I had a through and through, the bullet went straight through my right shoulder. And that was the first to heal when I was in hospital. And as soon as that healed, I asked for a laptop. My wife brought my laptop, and I wrote down everything I remembered about the attack. And that became the genesis of the first chapter of Blood and Sand. It took me quite some time before I got my head together enough to write a book properly. And I had a brilliant, still do, a great agent called Julian Alexander. I just can't praise him highly enough. He turned that idea into a best-selling book, which made the Sunday Times best-selling list, I think, for the first 3 weeks. And it was relatively straightforward because I was reciting the things that I'd been doing in Egypt. So not just the attack, but all the stuff that had led up to that, my interest in Arabic, my going to live with an Egyptian family, living with the Bedouin, what it was like to be a BBC correspondent in places like Iraq and Syria. And so I really enjoyed writing Blood and Sand, but it was quite poignant as well because there's a hospital chapter in there from Riyadh to rehab. And, you know, I described just what it's like being in a spinal injuries unit, realizing you can't use your legs. And it's pretty grim, but there are gradations of it. And I've got away relatively lightly. I can move my legs and I've got feeling of movement below the level of injury. So I'm totally paralyzed from my knees down, but I can feel down to there. There were people I was next to in hospital who couldn't feel a thing below their collarbone. And that's really tough. You know, they were totally dependent on others to wheel them around. So, you know, there's good and there's bad and there's stuff in between. And I still get to go to lots of really interesting places. And I've been to Africa by myself, to Lake Naivasha, with nobody helping. So, you know, sometimes I like to challenge myself. But coming back to the literature, yeah. So the second book was really a self-indulgent journey down memory lane. Far Horizons, I thought, let's get these stories out there while I remember them. And it's traveler's tales from places like Sumatra, Socotra, Djibouti, Colombia, slightly off the beaten track places, Djibouti, which I wove into a book with my own sketches. And it was never going to be such a big hit as Blood and Sand because I didn't get shot in it. And it's, you know, it's not as dramatic. And it's not about the Middle East. It's about lots of other places. But I wanted to give my sort of, forgive this, me saying this, my kind of brand a bit of depth. I wanted to show I'm not just this Middle East guy who bangs on about Al-Qaeda and stuff. So I wanted people to understand that I've also done a lot of traveling in Southeast Asia and South America, and I really enjoyed writing it. I wrote both these books in about 6 months, didn't take any time off work. Crisis is my first novel. It's my first fiction, and my God, it's a different world altogether. I've been on a learning curve as steep as the Angel Falls. You know, it's been great fun, and I'm loving writing fiction, but it's a totally, totally different ballgame from writing non-fiction. And one BBC presenter said to me glibly the other day, oh, everyone's writing fiction these days, I should really write one. Yeah, good luck to you on that one. Because, well, actually, you know, if you've got the time, fine. But I found it very hard to find the time. Inspiration, the writing, the narrative, that's fine. That all flows. It's setting aside the time to do it. And my daughters are going through A-levels and AS-levels at the moment, and it's very difficult to write at home. So I've got to go and sit in a cafe, bury myself there, and write with a glass of Montepulciano and an occasional bit of pasta and just plow through it. And the way it worked was I delivered the manuscript on time, the publisher sat on it for a month, and then the managing editor returned it and rang me up and said, right, Frank, you've got a package arriving today. I suggest you pour yourself a stiff drink. And 72 pages of edit notes arrived, which shows what a fantastic editor he is, Simon Taylor from Transworld. Brilliant. He's edited all three of these books. And, you know, again, I couldn't have wished for a better editor and a charming man as well. But my God, he's a tough taskmaster because he knows what sells and what doesn't. These are the people that, you know, that publish Lee Child and Da Vinci Code and things like that. They and Frederick Forsyth, they know what they're doing. So his 72 pages of notes, it wasn't criticisms, it was more comments and requests and tweaks. And so what did the place smell like, Frank? What did it feel like? Surely Luke would have thought this and that. Hang on, wasn't she back in Colombia by then or whatever? And there was one comment of his, so Frank, what exactly are the protocols for crossing the Panama Canal? I have no idea. So that was my weekend gone in one go, down Silku, because I not only had to find out, research that, but also to invent a character who would come on board the ship when it got to the edge of the Panama Canal and then weave that into the story, which is fun, but it's time-consuming.
Luke, your main character, is he autobiographical in any way?
No, he's not. He really isn't. Luke Carlton is this very... He's 34, so he's a lot younger than me for a start. He's incredibly fit in the old-fashioned sense of the word. A nice guy, but capable of extreme violence when called upon. Lost a finger in Afghanistan. He's ex-SBS, who did 8 years in the Royal Marines, 4 years in the SBS, which is still Royal Marines, but Special Boat Service. And I thought, well, you know, people are always writing about the SAS. Let's give the SBS a bit of airtime here, because they do incredibly dangerous and difficult things in places like Afghanistan and North Africa, and they don't get much publicity for it, which is partly what they like, but they lack the glamour and showbiz that is attached to SAS in many ways. And I've never served with special forces. I was a territorial cold warrior, infantry platoon commander, you know, totally different. And so, yes, although I suppose the only thing we, you know, probably have in common is enjoyment of kind of pushing ourselves physically and just the kind of just can do, get on with it attitude. But it ends there. I've never shot anybody, and Luke shoots lots of people in this book.
Who's your market for this?
That's a really good question. I want it to be as wide as possible. I would hope that this isn't... I mean, my 17-year-old daughter, who read 100 books last year, she's a complete bibliophile, and her first reaction was, Daddy, it's 450 pages, that's much too long. But she's read it cover to cover, and she won't say it to me, but she's been telling friends how much she liked it. So that's great. I'm not saying she's my market, but I would love it if 17-year-olds enjoy this book. But I want the kind of, hey, LitFest public to pick up this book and enjoy it. You know, these are voracious readers who know a good thriller and are not going to have any time for something that doesn't tick the boxes. They want a page-turner, and I really hope I've given them one here. Yeah. I've ended a lot of the chapters on cliffhangers. I want people to think, oh, my God, what happens next? Oh, my God, it's quarter past midnight. I really should... No, do you know what? I'm going to read one more chapter because I've got to know what happens to him. That's what I want people to think.
Because there is a kind of formula, isn't there, in leading people on that cliffhanger-type journey?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I very much wanted to surprise people with this, Georgina. I want to come at people left field. I want... People are going to think, oh, well, he's written a thriller. Frank Gardner, I bet it's about the Middle East. I bet it's ISIS. No, it's not. You know, this is not... Although I've taken some things from my day job, and I've interviewed a lot of people for this, nobody actually in government, but people who've retired, ex-spooks, ex-special forces, some serving military, but just to get the methodology right, the process. And, yeah, I've chosen South America as the milieu, because I wouldn't say I know Colombia, but I've been there several times, and I've embedded with anti-terrorist groups, anti-kidnap units, police special forces. So the jungla that I described, this elite commando unit, does exist, and I've seen them in action, and they're pretty impressive. So I wanted to make it quite different. So it's narco-terrorists as opposed to, you know, ISIS and stuff from Syria.
Frank, you've been through so much, and yet you continue, as you say, going off to Africa on your own and travelling around the world. You continue to do this. Why? What drives you now?
It's really fun. I mean, life's out there to be enjoyed. I know that's such a cliche, but I mean, I'm about to go to Papua New Guinea. This will be my 96th country. And I've still got 100 and something to go. I'd never been to Argentina. I'd never been to Nigeria. There's so many countries I still want to go to explore. Tanzania, huge gap. So, yeah, I'm very excited about a lot of the places I still want to go to. I don't seek out danger. There's a difference between adventure and danger. So I've never really seen myself as a flak jacket journalist. I'm not one of these people that sort of enjoys ducking bullets and saying, the fight's going on above my head. That's not me. You know, I'll take a calculated risk. And I know this is odd coming from somebody who's been shot 6 times. And sure, when I came out of hospital, I was very timid. I had no energy for anything. We went to Thailand to recover for a week on a lounger by a pool, and I had no energy to do anything. There was an advert for Jungle Tours, and I thought, nah, no interest, sorry. But I'm back now.
Frank, your book is out.
Yeah, this is exciting stuff. This is a new departure for me, and it's a trilogy. So the first thing the publishers asked before they commissioned it was, does your hero have legs? Which is kind of ironic in my case, given that mine don't work. But yes, most definitely he does. I've already started work on the second book, which I hope will be out next year, and is going to take him to a very different part of the world with a very different enemy, and different things are going to happen to him and his girlfriend. So this is hugely exciting. I work within the straitjacket of objective news journalism, and this is different. This is liberating. You know, I'm floating up like a balloon writing this stuff. It's great.
Frank Gardner, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Georgina.
And the action-packed debut thriller from Frank Gardner, Crisis, is published in hardback by Bantam Press. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin, and thanks to my producer, Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. Thank you for listening.